Before we jump straight into the deep end today, this deep dive is actually brought to you by CertFuel.
Oh,
Yeah.
nice.
They've got this really incredible full series 99 course. It has, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, that weighting is super important.
It really is. So you can check that out at certfuel.com. Keep it casual, but seriously, go check them out.
Absolutely.
But okay, let's get into it. Listen up, because what we are covering today is, well, it's customer privacy,
Right.
which is function two of the Series 99 exam.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It is a massive one. That is 15 scored items.
Wow.
I mean, that is literally 30% of your entire exam.
30%. Yeah, so you really can't just skim this section.
No, you absolutely cannot. And I think, for a lot of people studying, it's really easy to fall into this trap. Like, you think about privacy and you just picture that that really boring, dense pamphlet you get in the mail when you open a checking account.
The one with the tiny font.
Exactly. The one that goes straight into the recycling bin, right?
Right.
You don't even read it.
Nobody reads it.
But we have to look at this totally differently for the exam. We have to look at it through the lens of like an operations professional.
Right, because that pamphlet, it's really just the visible tip of this massive multi-million dollar compliance iceberg.
I love that analogy. An iceberg.
Yeah, because from a regulatory standpoint, privacy isn't just a piece of paper. It's this incredibly strict, heavily audited operational control.
Right.
I mean, a firm actually has to engineer this whole complex architectural
To
framework.
basically decide who gets what, right?
Exactly. It's constantly deciding who gets access to what piece of data, why they even need it in the first place, and whether that data is legally permitted to travel across an internal server.
Let alone outside the firm.
Right, let alone outside the firm. So if you really want to understand how the market functions, you have to understand the friction of moving information.
Okay, the friction of moving information. I like that.
Yeah.
But to make sense of this friction, without just getting completely lost in textbook jargon, because I know that puts me right to sleep, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters today.
Oh, I love a good cast of characters.
Right, it just makes it stick in your brain better. So think of these guys as our test subjects who are going to be traversing this whole regulatory architecture we just talked
Oh,
about.
okay, lay them on me.
All right, first up, we have Fiona the fiduciary.
Fiona.
Yeah, she works as a transfer agent at this massive broker-dealer.
Right, so her job is basically maintaining the records of who owns what stock.
Exactly, which means she essentially just sits on this giant server that contains everyone's deepest financial secrets.
A very powerful position.
Oh, hugely powerful. Okay, next we have Frank, the founder.
Frank.
Frank is the CEO of Frank's Frankfurter franchise.
Frankfurter franchise, that is a mouthful.
It is a publicly traded company,
I
an absolute hot dog empire.
love it.
And Frank is the issuer of the stock. And he really wants to know who is buying his company, who's voting for his board members, who's backing the hot dogs.
Naturally, he wants to know his investors.
Right. And finally, we have Nervous Ned.
Oh, nervous Ned.
Yes. Ned is our retail investor. He buys shares of Frank's hot dog company, but he does it through Fiona's broker-dealer.
Oh, okay, so he's the client.
He is the client. And Ned, he is highly, highly protective of his digital footprint. I mean, the guy probably wears the tinfoil hat while he's browsing the web.
Ray, he doesn't want anyone tracking him.
No, he just wants to execute his trades. He doesn't want his data sold to marketers. He doesn't want it stolen by hackers. And he definitely doesn't want it shared without his consent.
Okay, so we've got Fiona the fiduciary, Frank the founder, and Nervous Ned.
You got it.
Setting up those relationships is just. It's so crucial because I think the biggest misconception about privacy is that people think it only applies to data leaving a building.
Right, like being sold to an ad agency or something.
Exactly. But before we can even look at Ned's data going to an outside marketing firm, we have to examine the internal pipes.
The internal pipes, okay.
Yeah, we have to look at how data moves inside the firm itself. Because customer information, it is not just some general free-for-all resource that any department in the building can just tap into whenever they feel like it.
Oh, okay. So let's explore that internal restriction, because I think this is where a lot of the exam traps live.
Oh, 100%.
So we have Fiona the fiduciary. And because she operates as a transfer agent for Frank's Frankfurter franchise, she just possesses this incredibly detailed list of securities ownership.
Right, she knows every
She
security.
knows the names, the account sizes, the purchasing habits, Every single person buying that hot dog stock, she has their info.
A literal gold mine.
It's a gold mine. From a business perspective, that list is invaluable. So let me ask you a direct question. Let's play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
Fiona's broker-dealer has a retail sales division, and they're sitting right down the hall from her.
Just down the hall.
Yep. And they are launching a brand new, highly lucrative mutual fund.
Okay.
Why can't those retail brokers just ping Fiona's database, run a quick filter for high net worth investors on her list, and just start cold calling them? I mean, the firm owns the servers, right?
Right.
The firm pays Fiona's salary. So why on earth is that internal data sharing a regulatory violation? So I want everyone listening to just take a second and think about that.
Yeah, pause for a second. Think about
it. Okay, so they own the servers. They pay her. Can they use the list to cold call for their new mutual fund?
And the answer is absolutely no.
Emphatically no.
Emphatically no. You cannot do that. And it comes down to this legal concept of capacity.
Capacity. Okay, break that down for me.
So when a firm acts as a transfer agent or a paying agent or a trustee, they are operating in a strict fiduciary capacity for the issuer.
Okay.
Frank hired them to perform a highly specific administrative function.
Right. He hired them to keep the ledger, not to, you know, sell mutual funds.
Mm, exactly. So the data Fiona collects, it's entrusted to her solely to execute that function.
Got it.
If the retail side of her broker-dealer accesses that information to build their own marketing pipeline, they are essentially misappropriating the issuer's proprietary data. They're using it for their own commercial benefit.
And regulators do not like that.
Oh, they hate it. That's why the regulatory framework, it forces these firms to build what are basically information barriers.
Like digital walls.
Digital walls, operational walls, all of it. They have to prevent the fiduciary side of the business from bleeding into the retail side or the proprietary trading side.
So to summarize that, Fiona obtained the data to maintain a ledger for Frank. She did not obtain it to help her firm's retail brokers hit their quarterly sales quotas.
Perfect way to put it. The boundary is completely defined by the purpose of the collection. Fiduciary information performs its specific function, period.
Okay, but let's look at the operational reality of this. Because, like you said, the Series 99 exam is absolutely notorious for testing the exceptions to these absolute rules.
Oh yeah, they love an exception.
So are there any scenarios where those internal walls can be breached legally? Like, can a firm ever use that fiduciary data to solicit purchases or sales or exchanges?
Okay, this is where the exam tries to get you.
Everybody listen up.
There's exactly one exception, just one, and it hinges entirely on the issuer's agency.
The issuer being Frank.
Frank. So the member firm can solicit purchases, sales, or exchanges only if the issuer, Frank the founder, specifically requests the solicitation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the member firm has to conduct it strictly on the issuer's behalf.
Only on his behalf.
Right. So let's say Frank is trying to execute like a tender offer.
Or maybe he wants to encourage his current shareholders to participate in a new secondary offering. Like they're launching a new vegan bratwurst and they need capital.
Exactly. A vegan bratwurst offering. So Frank can authorize Fiona's firm to use that transfer agent list to reach out to the investors.
Okay.
But the absolute crucial distinction here is that the firm is acting as a megaphone for Frank.
Right. They're just his mouthpiece.
Exactly. They are not using the list to cross-sell their own in-house mutual funds or their wealth management services.
So I have an analogy for this that I think really helps it stick.
Let's hear it.
It's basically like borrowing your buddy's truck to help him move a couch.
Okay. I'm with you.
So Frank asks you, hey, can you borrow my truck to help me move my couch to my new apartment? And you say, sure, you have the keys to the truck. You are driving the truck.
Right.
But you cannot use his truck to just suddenly start your own side hustle moving business on the weekends.
No, you definitely can't.
Right. You can't just be like, well, I have the truck. I might as well charge people to move their stuff. No. You can only move things if he specifically asks you to do it for him.
That is a perfect analogy because it really highlights the concept of custody versus ownership.
Yes.
The broker-dealer has custody of the data, like you have custody of the truck.
Right.
But the issuer dictates the utility of the data.
Frank owns the truck. He says what it does.
Exactly. So if the exam presents a scenario where a firm uses fiduciary info for its own benefit, the answer is an immediate no.
Just cross it out.
Cross it out. If the scenario involves a solicitation that the issuer did not explicitly request, the answer is no.
It'd have to be requested by the issuer.
Requested by the issuer, executed on the issuer's behalf.
Excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
So that really covers the internal walls. We have fully established that Fiona cannot let her own coworkers rummage through that fiduciary database.
No rummaging.
But eventually, a firm is going to need to share data with the outside world, right?
Yeah, it's unavoidable.
They have to use third-party vendors for statement printing or cloud hosting or, you know, external marketing.
Yep, all of that.
Which perfectly transitions us into this massive regulatory framework. We are talking about the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, specifically Regulation SP.
Regulation SP, the privacy bouncer.
The bouncer. I love that. So let's talk about Reg SP.
Well, to really understand Regulation SP, you kind of have to understand the historical friction that created it in the first place.
Okay, give us the history lesson.
So back in the late 1990s, the barriers between commercial banks and investment banks and insurance companies were basically just being torn down.
It was a free-for-all.
It really was. You suddenly had these absolute financial behemoths merging together and consolidating just unimaginable amounts of consumer data.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So there was this genuine, very real fear that, say, your mortgage lender would take your financial vulnerabilities and share them with your insurance provider.
Yikes.
And then the insurance provider would share it with an affiliated brokerage firm, all just to exploit your data profile and sell you more stuff.
That is exactly Nervous Ned's worst nightmare.
It is. So Regulation SP was enacted to basically put a leash on all of this data sharing.
Okay, putting a leash on it.
And the entire rule orbits around a very specific classification of data called NPI.
NPI, which stands for non-public personal information.
Exactly, non-public personal information.
Okay, let's clearly define the boundaries of NPI. Because from what I understand, this is where compliance departments basically spend half their time arguing.
They absolutely do.
So the standard textbook definition is that NPI is personally identifiable financial information that isn't publicly available.
Right.
It is the secret sauce of Nervous Ned's financial life.
His whole recipe.
So let me challenge that definition really quick. I got another test for you.
Oh, boy. Okay.
What if Fiona's firm takes Nervous Ned's profile and they decide to run it through a scrubbing algorithm?
Scrubbing it, okay.
Yeah, so they strip out his social security number, they delete his account number entirely, and they remove his exact street address.
So he's anonymized.
Exactly. Mm. All they do is dump him into an aggregated consumer grouping. So let's call this new list affluent New York residents who love hot dog stocks.
Very niche-less.
Very niche. Furthermore, what if they actually built that list by cross-referencing his brokerage account with publicly available real estate records?
Okay, so mixing public and private.
Right, so my question is a scrubbed, partially public list still considered non-public personal information?
It is. It is entirely protected.
Wait, really? Even though it's scrubbed?
Yes. And this right here, this is a major trap for candidates on the exam.
Okay, pay attention, folks.
Even if you have groupings or lists that are derived from personally identifiable financial information, they are treated as NPI, period.
Even if it has public info mixed in.
Regardless of whether the grouping contains public information, the rationale here is that the relationship itself is proprietary.
Oh, I see.
If a disclosure indicates that someone is, or even was, a consumer of a specific financial institution, that connection alone is protected.
So just the fact that Ned does business with Fiona's firm is a piece of protected metadata.
Precisely. You cannot just strip the social security number off a file, match it up with public tax records, and then suddenly declare the resulting profile public.
You can't just wash the data.
Exactly. Regulators say you cannot launder private data through public aggregators to bypass the privacy rules. The genesis of that data came from a non-public protected financial relationship.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's look at how Regulation SP actually operationalizes this protection day to day.
Let's do it.
It's essentially a framework built on four core duties. And to make this really tangible, I like to visualize data as a physical asset moving down a highly secured highway.
A highway. Okay, paint the picture.
All right. So the first duty is notice.
Right, the privacy notice.
Customers must receive a clear, conspicuous privacy notice that explains the firm's information sharing practices. And this happens when the relationship is established and then annually after that.
The one that goes in the recycling bin.
Recycling bin pamphlet, exactly. But think of the notice as the map. It shows Nervous Ned the exact information path his data might travel, who might look at it, and why.
The map. I like that.
So that's the first duty. The second duty is safeguards.
Ah, the bouncers.
Yes. The firm must protect customer records from unauthorized access. So if the privacy notice is the map of the highway, The safeguards are the armored trucks and the armed guards patrolling the route.
And let me tell you, those safeguards, they cannot just be some vague corporate philosophy, like, we promise we'll try to be safe.
Right. You can't just have a poster in the break room saying, be careful with data.
Right, right.
The regulation requires actual written policies and procedures. A firm has to document its administrative, its technical, and its physical safeguards.
So give me some examples of that. What does that actually look like?
Sure. So it means everything from encrypting databases and requiring multi-factor authentication.
That's the technical stuff.
Yep. To physically locking file cabinets and restricting keycard access to server rooms. That's the physical side.
Literally locking the door.
Exactly. When regulators conduct an examination, they don't just sit down and ask if you're being careful.
Yeah.
They ask to see the engineering of your locks. They want proof.
Wow. Okay. So that brings us to the third duty, which is disposal. Disposal, getting rid of it.
Yeah. Eventually, the data reaches the end of its life cycle, right? You don't need it forever.
Yeah.
But you can't just drag Ned's printed portfolio into the alley dumpster behind the branch office.
Please do not do that.
And you definitely cannot just sell old hard drives on the internet without wiping them first.
People have tried.
Firms must use reasonable, permanent measures to securely trash the data.
And we have seen massive, massive regulatory fines levied against firms that failed this disposal requirement.
Really? Just for throwing stuff away?
Oh, yeah. Because simply dragging a file to the recycling bin on your desktop, that does not remove it from a server.
Right.
Firms have to employ cryptographic erasure. They have to do actual physical destruction of magnetic media. Or use secure shredding protocols for paper.
Like actually melting the hard drives.
Sometimes literally physically destroying them, yes. The life cycle of NPI does not end until the data is irretrievably destroyed.
Irretrievably destroyed. Okay, yeah. So notice is the map. Safeguards are the guards. Disposal is the incinerator. Those three feel pretty straightforward, just solid operational controls.
Yeah, they make logical sense.
But the fourth duty, this one is the most heavily tested on the Series 99 and honestly the most behaviorally complex.
Oh, without a doubt.
It is the opt-out rule for non-affiliated third parties.
Okay, let's really break this down.
Yeah, explain the opt-out rule.
So when a firm wants to share ServiceNet's NPI with a non-affiliated third party.
It's an external marketing agency.
Right. An external marketing agency that has absolutely no legal relationship to the broker dealer.
Okay.
And assuming no existing regulatory exception applies, the firm must give Ned a reasonable opportunity to opt out of that disclosure.
Wait, notice the phrasing you just used there. The customer gets the chance to opt out.
Yes. Opt out.
I really want to drill into the behavioral economics of this because I think it's fascinating. The distinction between opt-in and opt-out literally dictates how millions of data points move across the economy every single day.
It changes everything.
So why did the regulators settle on an opt-out framework? Why not require firms to get active opt-in consent before sharing anyone's data?
It is a phenomenal question, and it really comes down to a battle between market efficiency versus consumer friction.
Friction again.
Right. So opt-in requires affirmative friction. It means Fiona's firm cannot share a single byte of Ned's data until Ned actively signs a form, clicks a button, or verbally agrees to the sharing.
Which, from a consumer advocacy standpoint, opt-in sounds like the gold standard of privacy.
It is the gold standard for privacy. But the financial industry argued, and they argued successfully, that an opt-in requirement would completely paralyze the modern financial system.
Why? Just because people are lazy.
Basically, yes. Customers routinely ignore paperwork.
True.
If firms had to wait for active consent for every single routine third-party disclosure, I mean, basic services like statement generation or fraud monitoring or joint marketing agreements, they would just grind to a halt.
Because nobody would return the form.
Exactly. Therefore, Regulation SP relies primarily on the opt-out framework. Opt-out assumes consent by silence.
Consent by silence. Wow.
The firm sends the notice. If Ned throws it in the trash and does absolutely nothing, the firm is legally permitted to share the data.
The burden is on Ned.
The burden of action is placed entirely on the consumer. Ned has to actively raise his hand, fill out the form, or call the 1-800 number to forbid the sharing. If he doesn't, they share it.
Okay, that is a huge exam point. On the test, do not select opt-in. The customer gets to opt out.
Write that down, opt out.
So let's trace the liability path here because I've got another scenario for you.
Bring it on.
Let's say Fiona's firm follows the letter of the law perfectly. They mail ServiceNet his privacy notice, with a very clear opt-out provision.
Okay.
Ned, being a typical retail investor, assumes it's junk mail and just chucks it in the trash.
Standard Ned.
Standard Ned. The 30-day waiting period expires. So Fiona's firm bundles Ned's NPI, and they transfer it to that external, non-affiliated marketing firm.
Okay, data has left the building.
Right, so direct question for the listeners. Once that data is securely transferred to the third party, is Fiona's firm absolved of liability?
Think about it for a second.
Like, if the marketing firm suffers a massive data breach next week, can Fiona point to that ignored opt-out notice and say, hey, we followed the rules, the data was out of our hands, not our problem?
The regulatory answer is a resounding absolute no.
No. They are still on the hook.
They are totally on the hook. Sharing data with a third party does not sever the firm's responsibility for privacy controls.
Wow.
When a broker-dealer transmits NPI to a non-affiliated third party, they have to ensure that the third party is bound by strict confidentiality agreements.
They have to police the third party.
Yes. The third party is generally restricted from using that data for anything other than the specific purpose for which it was disclosed.
Right. They can't just take Ned's data and sell it to five other companies.
Exactly. Fiona's firm has an ongoing obligation to perform vendor due diligence. They actually have to audit the marketing firm's cybersecurity posture.
They have to check their locks, too.
Yes. You cannot just toss protected data over the corporate fence and wash your hands of the liability. The regulatory exposure travels with the data.
The regulatory exposure travels with the data. That is such a good phrase to remember.
It really is.
Okay, let me just aggressively ring a metaphorical bell right here.
Ring it.
Stop right here, everyone listening. Do not confuse these next two concepts on the test.
Oh, this is the big one.
If I am an operations associate listening to this, my brain is probably starting to blur the lines of liability.
It happens to the best of us.
We just spent all this time talking about Regulation SP, which is about safeguarding data and building walls and opt-outs.
Right.
But what happens when the walls actually fail? Because privacy rules assume a world where you have control over the perimeter.
Right. They do.
But what if a bad actor bypasses the opt-out notices, bypasses the information barriers, and simply breaks in?
Right. They just smash a window.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Privacy rules cannot help you if the hacker is already inside the house.
No, they can't.
And that is why the regulatory framework requires an active secondary defense mechanism.
And now we are crossing the boundary from data privacy to fraud prevention.
We are leading Regulation SP.
And we are entering Regulation SID.
SID. Okay, give me the side-by-side comparison, because candidates mix these up constantly.
They really do. Okay, so this is a foundational operational distinction you have to compartmentalize for the exam.
Yep.
Reg SP, think P for privacy.
P for privacy.
It's focused on the authorized handling of information. It dictates how a firm shares data with legitimate partners. It's safeguarding the NPI.
Okay.
Reg SID, think ID for identity theft.
ID for identity theft.
Oh, right. It is focused on unauthorized exploitation. It dictates how a firm detects and mitigates identity theft when it's actively happening.
So to use an analogy, Reg SP is the deadbolt on the front door.
Yes.
Reg SID is the smoke detector wired into the ceiling.
That is exactly it. You hope the deadbolt keeps the intruders out.
Right.
But if a fire starts inside the living room, the deadbolt is completely useless. You need a system that actively scans the environment for anomalies, for smoke.
For fires that are already burning.
Exactly.
However, before a firm has to build this massive, complex smoke detection system, there is a jurisdictional threshold, isn't there?
There is.
Reg SID doesn't mandate a massive fraud department for every single account in existence.
No, that would be impossibly expensive.
So it only applies if the firm offers or maintains what the SEC calls covered accounts.
Covered accounts.
So how does an account trigger that classification? What makes it covered?
So a covered account is generally defined as an account offered primarily for personal, family, or household purposes.
Hmm.
That is designed to permit multiple payments or transactions.
Okay, so think of a standard retail brokerage account.
Right, one with check writing privileges, debit card access, margin lending.
Things that let money move fast.
Exactly. These accounts are highly liquid and highly transactional, which makes them prime targets for malicious actors.
Hackers want liquid cash.
They absolutely do. Now contrast that with a strictly institutional account. Or maybe like a lockup fund where capital cannot be moved for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
The friction in those institutional accounts makes rapid identity theft incredibly difficult.
A hacker doesn't want to wait 5 years to steal your money.
No, they want it today.
Yeah.
So the rule also includes this sort of catch-all provision. any other account that presents a reasonably foreseeable risk of identity theft to customers or to the safety and soundness of the financial institution.
So basically, if Ned's account allows him to wire funds on demand, it is a covered account.
Yes, it is a covered account, and it mandates the creation of a written identity theft prevention program.
Okay, a written identity theft prevention program. And this program cannot just be like the IT guy in the basement monitoring server logs, right?
Oh, definitely not.
The regulation demands a formal written program built on four distinct pillars.
Oh, pillars.
So let's walk through the mechanics of how a firm actually engineers these four pillars.
Yeah.
And let's use Nervous Ned as our hypothetical victim.
Poor Ned.
Poor Ned. Let's assume Ned's worst nightmare comes true. He falls for a very sophisticated phishing email.
Oh.
Maybe it promised him free tinfoil hats. I don't know. But a bad actor captures his login credentials.
Okay, so the hacker is now inside the system.
They are inside the house. So the first pillar of the SID program is identify.
Identify.
What does that mean in practice?
The firm must identify relevant red flags.
Red flags.
Yeah. And a red flag in this context is a specific observable pattern, practice, or activity that indicates the possible existence of identity theft.
Okay.
The firm's compliance team actually has to sit down and map out what fraudulent behavior realistically looks like for their specific business model.
They're compiling a threat library.
Exactly. So a red flag might be an address change followed immediately by a request for a replacement debit card.
That's a classic one.
Super common. Or it might be a login attempt from an IP address in a country the client has literally never visited.
Like Ned logging in from Antarctica.
Right. Or it might be a sudden liquidation of really stable blue chip stocks, followed by an outbound wire transfer to some unfamiliar external bank.
So identifying is just the act of defining the anomalies.
Yeah.
Figuring out what smoke looks like.
Yes. Defining what smoke looks like.
Which leads us to the second pillar, detect.
Detect.
Because identifying the red flags is completely useless if you don't have the technological infrastructure to actually spot them happening in real time.
Right. The smoke detector has to be wired to the power grid.
Exact.
Detection is where the theoretical program meets the operational reality.
Okay.
The firm must incorporate those identified red flags into their actual monitoring systems. And this requires complex algorithmic surveillance.
The computers have to be looking for it.
Right. So when the hacker logs into Ned's account from that foreign IP address in Antarctica and then attempts to wire $50,000 to buy penguin statues or whatever,
right.
The order management system must be programmed to recognize that exact sequence of events as a match to the threat library.
It sees the smoke.
It sees the smoke. The system must detect the anomaly at the exact moment of execution.
So the alarm goes off,
which
triggers the third pillar.
Response.
Response. You saw the smoke. You heard the alarm. Now you actually have to extinguish the fire.
Right. The firm must respond appropriately to the detected red flags to prevent and mitigate the identity theft.
This is the incident response phase.
Exactly. So what does that look like? The automated system might instantly freeze the outbound wire transfer.
Just stop the money from leaving?
Stop it right there. It might temporarily lock Ned account access entirely.
Okay.
Then a fraud analyst is alerted and they attempt to contact Ned through a verified out-of-band communication channel.
Out-of-band? What does that mean?
Like calling the trusted phone number on file rather than emailing the potentially compromised email address?
Right, because the hacker might be reading the email.
Exactly. The response must be proportional to the risk,
yeah.
And it must actively halt the unauthorized exploitation of the account.
Okay, so we've got identify the threat, detect the threat, respond to the threat.
Yep.
But there is a fourth pillar, and it exists because the threat landscape is not static. Hackers get smarter.
Oh, they definitely do.
So the fourth pillar is periodically update.
Periodically update. Because hackers are incredibly innovative. I mean, the moment the financial industry builds a wall, malicious actors build a taller ladder.
It's a constant arms race.
It is. Think about it. 5 years ago, firms were dealing with simple password stuffing.
Just guessing passwords over and over.
Right. Today, they are dealing with SIM swapping, synthetic identity fraud, and AI-generated voice cloning attempting to bypass telephone authentication.
The AI voice cloning is terrifying.
It's wild. So if a firm's identity theft prevention program relies on a threat library that was compiled back in 2018,
it's basically useless.
It is fundamentally broken. The regulation requires the firm to periodically update the program, including the relevant red flags, to reflect changes in risks to customers.
So it requires ongoing threat intelligence gathering and continuous system recalibration.
Exactly.
Let's summarize that architecture one more time, because it is highly testable.
Very testable.
The four pillars of regulation SID are identify, detect, respond, and update.
Identify, detect, respond, update.
And from a compliance perspective, I want to make this super clear. The incident response under SID is an entirely separate regulatory muscle from the incident response under regulation SP.
Oh, completely different.
SP is dealing with a privacy breach.
Right.
Say, an employee losing a laptop full of NPI on the subway.
Right.
SID is dealing with active identity theft mitigation, stopping a hacker from draining Ned's account in real time.
Yes. Keep those two regulatory frameworks sequestered in your mind. SKEY is privacy. SID is identity theft.
So we have spent a lot of time discussing how the firm protects Ned's data from external marketers and malicious hackers.
We have.
But let's flip the dynamic entirely.
Okay, flipping it.
What if Ned wants to hide his identity from the very company he is investing in? What if he wants to remain completely invisible to Frank the founder?
The plot thickens.
It does. This brings us to one of the most fascinating and honestly operationally dense corners of customer privacy. We're talking about beneficial owner elections.
Beneficial owner elections. This is a great topic.
Right. To understand why this is even an issue, we have to look at the mechanics of modern securities clearing.
Yeah. How the market actually works under the hood.
So when Nervous Ned buys 1,000 shares of Frank's Frankfurter franchise, he does not receive a physical paper stock certificate mailed to his house.
No, nobody gets paper anymore.
Could you imagine? The physical movement of paper would paralyze the modern trading volume. We trade billions of shares a day.
It would be a nightmare.
It would. So instead, the shares are what we call nominee held.
Nominee held.
This is commonly referred to on the exam as holding securities in street name.
Street name, right.
The shares are electronically registered on the issuer's books, on Frank's books,
under
the name of the broker dealer or a centralized clearing agency like the Depository Trust Company.
Okay, so from a legal perspective, the broker dealer is the owner of record.
They are the name on the ledger. But Ned is the true economic owner.
Right.
He is the beneficial owner, because he actually reaps the financial benefits of the stock. He gets the dividends, he absorbs the capital losses, he holds the voting rights.
It's his money on the line?
Exactly. But this creates a massive blind spot for Frank.
Oh, yeah.
Frank looks at his corporate registry and sees that Fiona's broker-dealer owns millions of shares. But Frank has absolutely no idea who the underlying retail investors are.
He just sees a wall of broker-dealers.
Right. And Frank cares deeply about this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you. Why does an issuer care who the beneficial owners are?
Issuers have a desperate need to communicate with their shareholder base. I mean, first of all, Frank needs to distribute annual reports.
Basic corporate governance.
Right. He needs to secure a quorum for proxy voting at the annual shareholder meeting.
Right. He needs votes.
But more aggressively, let's say Frank is facing a hostile takeover attempt by an activist hedge fund.
Oh, drama at the hot dog factory.
Major drama. He needs to know exactly who is accumulating his stock so he can lobby them directly to vote with current management.
He needs to call them up and say, hey, don't vote me out.
Exactly. So Frank asks the broker dealer to basically peel back that layer of street name registration and provide a list of the actual human beings who own the company.
And this is where the regulatory framework grants Nervous Ned a privacy toggle switch.
The toggle switch?
Yes. A beneficial owner of nominee-held securities has the legal right to choose whether their identity, their address, and their share positions are disclosed to the issuer.
Okay.
This election creates two distinct classifications of investors, and they come with two brilliant acronyms. I love these.
They're very catchy.
OBO and NOBO.
OBO and NOBO.
Let's break down the mechanics of the OBO first. The objecting beneficial owner.
Well, an OBO is exactly what the acronym implies. Nervous Ned explicitly objects to his identity being disclosed to Frank the issuer.
He objects.
He objects. He's instructing his broker dealer to maintain a strict wall of anonymity between himself and the company he owns.
Ned wants to wear an invisibility cloak.
Pretty much. But this creates immense operational friction.
How so?
Because Ned is an OBO, Frank cannot mail him a proxy ballot directly. He doesn't know who Ned is or where he lives.
Right.
So instead, Frank has to provide the proxy materials in bulk to the broker-dealer.
Okay.
The broker-dealer then has to take on the massive administrative burden of mailing the ballots to Ned, collecting Ned's vote, aggregating it with all the other OBOs, and passing the anonymized vote tally back to the issuer.
That sounds like a lot of work for the broker-dealer.
Oh, it is. And Frank actually has to pay the broker-dealer for the privilege of that administrative work.
Wow. Okay, so that's the OBO. Ned objects. Mm-hmm. He stays hidden.
Yep.
Conversely, we have the NOBO, the non-objecting beneficial owner.
Non-objecting. So if Ned designates himself as a NOBO, he is declaring that he has absolutely no objection to his identity being disclosed.
He's fine with it.
He's permitting the broker-dealer to just hand his name, his address, and his share quantity directly to Frank.
So that removes the broker-dealer as the intermediary for corporate communications.
Totally removes them. Frank can now mail the annual report directly to Ned's house. He can solicit Ned's proxy vote directly. From an issuer's perspective, NOBOs are transparent, accessible shareholders.
Frank loves NOBOs.
Frank loves NOBOs.
Okay, so memory aid check. OBO equals objects. NOBO equals no objection. Conceptually, it is very straightforward.
Very.
But let's look at the trap. Let's look at how this concept is weaponized on the Series 99 exam or just misunderstood in practice.
Yeah, because it happens all the time.
The confusion usually stems from the term beneficial owner. It sounds like a classification of property rights.
Right. It sounds legal and binding.
So pause and think about this question. If Ned fills out the regulatory paperwork, he checks the OBO box, and he legally objects to his identity being disclosed, does that administrative act alter his status as a beneficial owner?
Give it a beat. Does checking OBO change his ownership status?
Does the cloak of anonymity change his legal relationship to the underlying asset?
And the answer is not in the slightest.
Not at all.
And this is where candidates must be super precise. Beneficial ownership describes the absolute economic relationship to the securities.
Right.
The beneficial owner assumes the market risk and captures the market reward.
They get the cash.
They get the cash. The OBO and NOBO labels do not determine whether someone holds securities beneficially.
Okay, so what do they determine?
They strictly define the privacy routing of corporate communications. It is purely an information disclosure toggle switch.
So Ned owns the hot dog stock just as much as an OBO as he does as a NOBO.
Exactly the same amount. The only difference is whether Frank knows his name.
Got it. Furthermore, we must be really exact about the scope of this privacy, because Ned is wearing an invisibility cloak.
Yeah.
But who exactly is he hiding from?
Oh, another trap.
Right. When Ned checks the OBO box, is he hiding from the IRS?
No.
Is he hiding from the SEC?
Definitely right now.
Is he hiding from his own broker-dealer? So who is he hiding from?
He's hiding from one entity and one entity only, the issuer.
Just Frank.
Just Frank. The OBO objection is specifically narrowly targeted at preventing disclosure to the company whose stock is being held. It offers zero protection against regulatory subpoenas, tax reporting requirements, or the internal compliance monitoring of the broker-dealer itself.
Okay, that is incredibly clear. Only hiding from the issuer.
Yep.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of operational architecture today.
Covered a lot of ground.
We mapped the internal pipes, the external walls, the fraud detectors, and the proxy voting anonymity switches.
The whole iceberg.
The whole iceberg. And because this represents 30% of your exam, 30%. We're going to do a high-energy, rapid-fire sprint through the absolute most testable mechanics we just explored.
Okay, let's lock this in.
Rapid fire. First, fiduciary information. The internal handoff. If Fiona possesses data because she is acting as a transfer agent, can her firm use it to build a marketing pipeline?
Absolutely not. The data belongs to the function. You cannot use fiduciary info for your own solicitations. You can only use it to solicit if the issuer explicitly requests it and you execute it strictly on their behalf.
Second, regulation SPI, the privacy bouncer. What is the core definition of the data it protects? And what are the four duties?
It protects NPI, non-public personal information. And remember the track, even scrub data derived from non-public relationships is still NPI.
It's still NPI.
The four operational duties are notice, safeguards, disposal, and opt-out. And crucially, for sharing with non-affiliated third parties, the regulatory standard is that the customer is given the right to opt-out. Do not select opt-in.
Do not select opt-in. Third, regulation SID, the smoke detector. When does it apply and what is the framework?
It applies to covered accounts. Those are accounts that permit multiple transactions or pose a foreseeable risk of identity theft.
Like checking or margin accounts.
Right. And the firm must build a written program based on four pillars: identify the red flags, detect them in real time, respond to mitigate the theft, and periodically update the threat library.
Identify, detect, respond, update.
Yep.
Finally, the OBO versus NOBO election.
OBO means the beneficial owner objects to the issuer knowing their identity. NOBO means they have no objection.
And does it change ownership?
No. It is an administrative privacy election regarding corporate communications, not a legal classification of economic ownership.
That is the architecture of customer privacy. That is how the industry protects the transfer agent, the issuer, and the retail investor.
Nailed it.
But, you know, before we wrap up completely, I want to leave everyone listening with a little bit of a theoretical challenge.
Oh, a thought exercise.
Yeah, something that compliance officers are currently wrestling with as technology basically outpaces regulation.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've spent this entire deep dive relying on a very neat, legally defined boundary between what is public and what is non-public.
Right.
We stated that deriving a list from NPI makes the list protected.
Right, laundering the data doesn't work.
But consider the modern data landscape. Algorithms and artificial intelligence, they don't actually need to steal a database to figure out who Nervous Ned is anymore.
No, they really don't.
An AI could just scrape his public social media likes, cross-reference his public property tax records, analyze his geotagged photos from vacation, and deduce his exact net worth, his banking relationships, and his investment risk tolerance with terrifying accuracy.
It's scary how good they are at that.
It is. So if a machine can piece together a perfectly accurate, highly sensitive financial profile using only freely available harmless public data points,
Yeah.
at what point does the regulatory definition of non-public personal information just completely collapse?
Wow, that's a great question.
Right. If an algorithm can basically see the invisible ink, how do we regulate the secret?
That is something the SEC is going to be losing sleep over for the next decade.
Exactly. The perimeter of privacy is dissolving, and it's not because the locks are broken, but because the walls are made of glass.
Walls made of glass. I like that.
It is a massive operational puzzle for the future of the financial industry. So keep that friction in mind as you navigate these rules and as you go in and absolutely crush this exam.
You're going to do great.
All right, that's it for this deep dive. Go check out certfuel.com, and we will see you on the next one.